Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, helping product managers become product masters. Listen and get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, this is Chad, your host, and this is where product managers become product masters. I also provide training to help you accomplish that. You can stop getting distracted by the multiple outlets that say they have product management training and focus instead on the foundational concepts that you need to really accelerate your career. Check out what it means to become a product master and how you accomplish that by using my free product mastery roadmap. That's at the same place where you'll find the show notes for this episode. And that's theeverydayinnovator.com/120. I've had the pleasure of interviewing guests with incredible insights for us product managers and innovators, and today's guest cuts through a lot of noise and presents clear principles for creating more successful products. My guest is the Chief Innovation Officer and Vice President of Innovation for Snap-on, the leading global innovator, manufacturer, and marketer of tools, diagnostics, and equipment solutions for professional users. His role is to drive innovative products, solutions, and processes that fundamentally change the markets that Snap-on serves and enhance customer perception of its brands. He's helped to create, support, and institutionalize a culture at Snap-on, something we'll be talking more about in the interview, a culture that embraces creativity, risk, and really a change in fearless innovation. Also, as you'll hear in the interview, prior to joining Snap-on, he spent 4 years in marketing at PepsiCo. Before joining PepsiCo, he was the marketing director of new products at Kraft Foods, and he's had 20 years of experience focused on new product development, marketing, and innovation. His name is Ben Britton, and I expect you'll find what he shared to be as valuable as I did. We had to conduct the interview by phone, so the audio quality is a little different than normal, but not distracting. The interview is next. Ben, thank you so much for joining the Everyday Innovator Podcast.
Thank you.
So I'm glad we could have the conversation, and I think we're going to kind of weave a little bit between experiences there with product development and management at Snap-on, maybe some of your earlier experiences in the food and beverage industry. And this is one transition I'm really curious about, because a lot of my listeners will sometimes send me emails and ask about, you know, I'm looking at trying to transition to a different industry and move out of what I'm in right now, and how can I do that? And you went from Kraft Foods, after earning your PhD in food and science, to PepsiCo, and then now to Snap-on Tools, which is recognized as the leader in professional tools, which is kind of a significant transition there. I understand the Kraft Foods and PepsiCo. Can you talk about what was involved in that transition for you?
Okay, and I'll step back a little bit, just a quick background. You know, when I went to college, I grew up with a family, I would say nobody had had what they would call an inside job. They were all either farmers or ranchers or construction workers. So I really had no idea what kind of jobs people did inside buildings. It was a bit of a mystery to me. So I started out in like basic biology, loved microbiology and genetics, ended up getting a master's degree in microbial genetics, mm-hmm. and didn't know what I wanted to do. So an opportunity came up with a fellowship in biotechnology through the National Academy of Sciences. And so I went to the University of Massachusetts and did a PhD in food science and nutrition. I loved food, but I really knew nothing about that field when I got there. So I got done, looked at a number of different opportunities, and ended up at Kraft Foods and biotechnology. And one of the funny things is I remember when I walked in the door the first day, I saw all the products. And I was working in what they call basic research in biotechnology, inventing ingredients and flavor substitutes and things like that. And I thought to myself, I really want to invent products. So it took a couple of years, and I moved from being a research principal in biotechnology over to being a manager in product development. I love doing new product development. I love food. I was trained as an expert taster and realized I had a little bit of a gift for being able to turn food terms into language and to write new product concepts. So that led to another big change, which was moving from R&D to marketing about 8-9 years into my career, which I think shocked most people because they kind of knew me as a guy who loved tinkering around with stuff and loved tinkering around making up new foods. And my kids loved it because I used to bring home some really crazy stuff like chocolate cheese, which they thought was absolutely disgusting. So when I moved to marketing, like, oh, this is so much better. You're not making us taste your failures anymore. So I went to work for Kraft in marketing. and worked on a bunch of different products, you know, and really, really just loved it there. And an opportunity came up to go to PepsiCo. I went to PepsiCo, did a lot of the same thing, ran innovation on shelf-stable beverages, then on Tropicana, and then finally on Quaker. Got a call one day about a job at Snap-on. I knew a little bit about Snap-on, but they said chief innovation officer. I loved working in innovation. I'd never heard of chief innovation officer, so I thought, I'm going to try that out. And I came here, and we had a CEO at the time. It's our previous CEO, Jack Michaels, and he really believed strongly in the power of process. So he brought in folks who did quality and what he called RCI. He hired me to come in and create a culture of fearless innovation, as well as to develop processes around what he called customer connection or customer insights, as well as innovation. And it seems like a weird transition because, clearly, I'm not a metallurgist. I'm not an engineer. I didn't know anything really about the products. But the essence of it is having some processes in place that you can use across any industry. It's also about really keeping the customer at the center. Mm-hmm. If you're customer-centric, it doesn't matter who the customer is. You understand that customer, and you come up with new ideas.
Absolutely. And what was the time frame for that transition to Snap-on?
I've been here almost exactly 10 years. It's hard to believe, but I came here in February of 2007, so it'd be just a little bit over 10 years ago.
Okay, and I'm curious, so this is some time has gone by, and you haven't had these experiences lately, but one thing when I talk to people that want to make this transition and how they position themselves is just as you emphasized there, you know, the power of process and that what we do in product management and development is really being in charge of that process to make those customer connections and understand what the problem is the customer's having and how can we bring them value. And sometimes making that change in industries, you're really the one that brings the fresh eyes into the situation. You don't make the assumptions that have been made before. Do you recall any of those kinds of experiences as you were at Snap-on?
So it's interesting. Having worked in against large corporations and everything from being on very specific product groups to product categories to big business units to corporate gigs, the one thing I knew coming in, when you're in a corporate gig, you can't become the corporate police because you're coming in with new ideas. People are going to be very resistant. You're not the subject matter expert. I may be a subject matter expert in innovation, mm-hmm. but I'm not in all the different product categories. And so it was about not carrying that big of a stick, not asking for a lot of rapid change in terms of, you know, both processes as well as kind of reporting stuff. There's nothing people hate than when corporate comes in and says, all right, I need you to spend like a month of a year pulling these numbers and pulling this information for me. What I really did was went and, you know, sort of inserted myself into the business groups and helped them fill their pipelines. And because of that, they were much quicker to embrace the idea of, oh, okay, we will tweak our process. Oh, this makes sense. We're actually seeing results out of it. So we delivered results before we hit as hard with the process hammer. Hmm. The other thing I was going to mention, I thought maybe we're going to go down this pathway, but I'll just talk about it really quickly. Some people say, well, you've been there 10 years. All the new stuff you did was kind of like in the first 2 years, you know, you added process, you tried to, you know, you changed the culture a fair amount, you're trying to still change the culture. Of course, I always say it's a never-ending journey. You built an innovation center, what else is there to do? One of the fascinating things about our business is the breadth of products and the global presence that we have. So for me, I probably have at least 20 locations where I have people doing product development and product management, and getting to all of those groups and making sure, you know, that they're all keeping their mind on the customer, they're keeping their pipelines full, is a little bit of a never-ending job. And we continue to make acquisitions. We make an acquisition or two every year of completely different businesses that we weren't in before. Mm-hmm. And the breadth of our business is so huge. You know, people think of us as hand tools, but probably 30-40% of our business is sort of in software and electronics. So we spend a lot of time, and I spend a lot of time working with software developers on keeping them focused on the customer because they may be sitting there just typing away on the code, you know, on a computer. They're not necessarily out sort of belly to belly, as we might say, with our customers watching them use the product. So we try to get them out and do that.
Yeah, which is excellent. We all need that time with customers to understand how they use our products and what are the problems they have that we can solve for them. And it's hard to find that time. It's nice to have a CIO that is encouraging that time to be spent and getting out with customers too. So let's talk about the actual product development management methodologies that you have put together that are in use there at Snap-on. Can you kind of walk us through the big pieces of what you do in terms of creating a product and adding value for customers?
Sure, and I'll talk a little bit about the process. So the one thing we made sure when we came in, when I came on board and, you know, working with Jack, who was the CEO at the time, was really making sure that all the product groups had a process, had a basic stage gate process. I don't care if they have 7 stages. I don't care if they have 20. That's really up to them because the products are so different and the way they go to market is so different and the development timelines are so different. So we made sure that everybody had a product process, which most groups did. Those that didn't, we helped them sort of institute a stage gate process and kind of lay that into place. And we don't police that heavily. All the groups seem very comfortable with their product development processes now and having a stage gate process in place. Where we came in kind of harder hitting was on 3 different fronts, and I'll talk about those each in detail. The first was making sure that all their ideas were based on real customer insights. They were out talking to end users, they understood what the need was, and they developed a product based on that. It wasn't just about folks down in the basement of the building coming up with ideas and throwing them against the wall to see what sticks. They really were making sure they watched customers, they had a specific application or a need or a complaint, and that started the idea. The other thing we really pushed hard on was to make sure that we were checking in with our users throughout the development process. When I first came, we were building prototypes at the plant level. So as you can imagine, you build a prototype, it can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars for a new toolbox prototype as an example, or power tool. These things were close to complete. They would go out and show them to customers, and of course customers would say, I don't like this, I like this, don't do this, but no one would ever change it because they had too much time and, you know, money into the development process. They might have been 9 months, 2 years, 3 years into product development before they ever showed a customer a prototype. So we've layered in both a lot of rapid prototyping capabilities as well as a process that says, okay, we're going to check in with customers all along the way. Doesn't have to, the exact number of times we do it doesn't matter, just so we check in when we have the idea, when we have sort of a concept, when we have a rendering, when we have a sort of non-functioning 3D prototype, when we have a full 3D prototype. Clearly, this is a lot easier with software where you can quickly throw together prototypes and easily change those. But doing that led to products that at the end really met our customer needs. And then the third thing we do is at the end, after launch, we circle back and make sure that in addition to just the product development team, that the folks who are in marketing and sales are delivering the message that reflects what that initial need was. Because we were occasionally having products that were launched, and then we'd look at the marketing message like, wait a minute, that's a true feature of the product, but it's not really what customers were asking for. So we need to deliver to them both the product that meets their needs, but we also need to have the messaging, the marketing materials, the pricing, everything else needs to reflect what that customer need is.
Those are 3 really good areas, and I just want to emphasize them for listeners too, because as far as our discussion together, that alone is gold for everyday innovators that are listening. And even if you're in a large company as you are and have been in your career, or just starting with a small product group, you know, these are really three key aspects of making sure your work is based on customer insights, watching and interacting with customers and addressing that specific need. And then so many times we do this when we're making products. We get that initial research done and we go off and do the development and we turn out a product and the customer says that wasn't quite what we wanted, right? And so continuing to do that check-in throughout the development process, prototype early, validate early, and continue on validating throughout development. And then after launch, making sure that the message that sales is carrying forward and that marketing has constructed is appropriate for the product and reflects that core customer need that you started with in the beginning. Those are 3 great areas.
And I think this is true for even from the individual inventor all the way to the $30 billion company. particularly this idea of a little bit of failing fast, which is what rapid prototyping allows you to do. And oftentimes people think about rapid prototyping as 3D printing, which we've invested a lot in. My group does a lot of 3D printing. We just got a metal scintillating printer that we put in one of our plants so we can actually print in metal now. But we have all kinds of 3D printing capabilities. However, prototyping also includes a rough sketch of the idea. It includes cutting stuff out of foam. It includes a color drawing, all of those things, because I think there are people who get afraid of this idea of rapid prototyping because they immediately go to the technology. And you don't have to have a high-tech solution. You can rapid prototype in your kitchen. You can rapid prototype in your garage. You know, people that are coders can easily rapid prototype on their computers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the things you can do with open source free 3D modeling tools online, the one that I've had a group use is Tinkercad, you know, simple to play with and use. And foam, you mentioned foam. Foam works great for throwing together physical prototypes. They don't have to be functional. We just want to get the initial ideas and get early feedback on them, and then we can make them functional over time. Excellent. So I like making, you know, kind of this process a little bit more tangible and specific for everyone listening. Can you take us on, I'll call it a product journey, a specific example of a product that, you know, you came across the need for this, whether it was an improvement of an existing product or a new product that needed it to, the customers needed to solve their problem, and how that came about?
Sure, and I can do as many examples or as few as you would like, and I'll pick up one that comes from the current industry that I'm in, and then I'll circle back at some point and tell a couple of fun food stories too, because some of those are quite enjoyable. A quick one that I think really reflects the need of observing customers, and I talked about that quite a bit. And when I use the word, I'll use the word customer and consumer and end user a little bit interchangeably. Having worked in a number of different industries, people define those different, but for the purposes of the discussion, just assume that when I say customer or consumer, I'm talking about the end user that actually uses the product. So probably 7-8 years ago, we did a deep dive into wind power, and we went around and visited a fair amount of wind farms. If you haven't been up on one, they're quite high. Most of them are about 80 meters. You climb up a metal ladder, which takes a while and hurts your feet, by the way, when you get to the top. At the top, there's a, they call it nacelle, which is where the generator is, and it's very, very tight space because the generator basically fills all that. The thing we didn't know till we did this work is that you climb out of the top and go out into the, if you can envision a wind generator, there's three big blades at the end, and there's a nose cone on there. You actually climb down into that nose cone where there's a fair amount of technology. And people who are servicing these units have to go out and do that. So we went and did this in the summer, and they were pulling out a ratchet and a socket and taking off four fasteners and crawling down in the hatch. And, you know, they, if we asked them, they said, oh, this is really no big deal. So we had done, I don't know, you know, months worth of work and thought, well, we saw a few different opportunities. But we went back in the winter, and it was early December in central Wisconsin, I guess. We were up just a little bit south of Green Bay. And I climbed a tower with the guy, and we went out there, and the top was covered in ice, and it was probably about 10, 15 degrees Fahrenheit out. And I was on my hands and knees. I have to admit, I apologize for the language, but I was scared shitless, because even though you're tethered in, you're going to hang there for a while in very cold temperatures. Mm-hmm. And he's wearing gloves and insulated coveralls and everything else, and it's taking forever to pull out the ratchet, take the socket, take off the fasteners. And we realized a couple of things. First of all, if he drops the ratchet and someone's down below, this becomes a lethal weapon. So we said, oh, we have to tether this tool to his belt. The other thing we came up with, and it seems like a very, very simple thing. It looks like a doorknob, but it's basically a composite sort of foam-based handle. Looks about the size of a doorknob. And then it has a permanently affixed socket to that. And we call it a palm ratchet. And that's tethered onto the guy's belt or lady's belt. They can go out and quickly remove these four fasteners. So it solves a couple of things. They're not fishing around trying to find the right size socket. They're not putting a socket onto a ratchet. They don't have to worry about dropping the ratchet because they've got this little palm ratchet that's attached to a lanyard and hooks onto their belt. Seems like a really simple solution, but if we would have just listened to what they told us and not observed, we would have never come up with this opportunity.
Having that personal experience with them led to new insights, like you said, when you ask them about them initially, it's like, yeah, it's no big deal to climb down into the nose cone, which I can't imagine. This is new information to me. I knew about the ladder going up into where the generator housing is, but not that you would actually have to climb outside and open up the nose cone and then climb into that also.
The other crazy thing about this, and I am not going to pretend to be an expert in wind power, but the because they actually rotate to catch the best wind, after 60 or 80 rotations, they have to then mechanically unwind. There's a motor in there that will turn the whole tower backwards because the cables inside get too tight from all the winding, because it usually typically winds the same direction. So you think about a 280-foot tower, the entire thing is rotating, and the cables inside getting tighter and tighter. It's actually very cool technology.
Absolutely. Another thing to think about. I'll have to observe and see next time I go through some wind farms if there are any that are unwinding themselves.
So another, I'll just give another really quick example, which I think sometimes we forget the power of aesthetics and design and products that people really want to pick up and have. We were doing a project on young technicians, and what we found when we talked to young technicians, and when I talk about technicians, these are primarily people who, you know, they fix cars and heavy-duty trucks and airplanes, which is really one of our core customers at Snap-on. And we would ask them about their future in the industry, and a lot of them would have concerns about injury and health. But they would never wear the safety gear. We said, well, why don't you wear the safety gear? Ah, it's just not cool enough. And the truth is we had sort of this plain, clear face mask that you use for grinding and doing some metal work. And it really wasn't very cool. But if you ask, like, okay, would you buy more? I'm not going to wear the stuff anyway. So we did a quick design project and came out with, and it's an entire line now. It's been hugely successful for us. But we started out with basically a protective face shield that's sort of like a helmet that looks like a skull. And this thing sold like crazy. It was unbelievable. People said, I'll never buy it and I'll never wear the safety gear. Bought millions of dollars of these. And it was a huge, huge new product for us. And a lot of folks would have said, well, like the category went up like 100-fold for you. How is that possible just by making it look cooler? But I think sometimes we forget that people love products that they just want to pick up, that they want to be seen with. They have a little bit of badge value, and they look great.
It's a good point. We often think of those tangible features of the product, and sometimes we call these the core features in terms of how does the product actually make you feel? How does it relate to your sense of achievement or power or coolness? And this idea, and I've seen these face shields before that look like skulls. And I look at them not at being at all close to knowing what mechanics and technicians do and think about. That's why I take my car to the mechanic, because I have no idea what I'm doing. And I just wondered why, you know, what's up with it looking like a skull? That makes sense that this now became cool and something desirable to actually not have, but also use.
Yep.
So power of aesthetics and design. So those are a couple of good examples for us. I'm curious about a food history one. You shared earlier that you would bring home prototypes of like chocolate cheese, and this might get interesting.
One of the other things, so as you think about what customers would tell you, and I'll just reiterate real quick. So, you know, one is I think the power of observation is absolutely critical in addition to listening. So the voice of the customer, oftentimes people just think about it as what customers say. Mm-hmm. But the voice of the customer includes what they say and what they do and observing what they do. The other piece of that is thinking beyond, and oftentimes I think engineers and product developers do get caught in the tangible benefits. They want this very concrete, measurable, like this is 10% better, or it does this new thing. But oftentimes, you know, the ergonomics, the way something fits in the hand, which we spend a lot of time on, you know, we've got engineers who love thinking about, you know, how much power a power tool puts out, but I've also got designers who love thinking about how does this tool look? How does it fit in the hand? So how does it look? How does it fit in the hand? When you look at it from a distance, do you have this, I got to pick it up? Mm-hmm. The third thing, though, that oftentimes happens with customers is that they will tell you what you want to hear. And clearly, listening well and the power of observation helps in this. But I'll tell a quick story. I worked for Kraft. I was working in corporate innovation. We had purchased this company called Nabisco. And Nabisco had a lot of products that some people might have considered not as healthy as other products, including Oreos. And we were quite concerned. This would have been probably 2002, right around then. And we were quite concerned about childhood obesity. The industry was under a lot of pressure about childhood obesity. I could spend probably 2 hours telling you all the reasons for it. But needless to say, we were concerned about our products, and we were concerned about both consumer pressure as well as regulatory pressure. So one thing that we started to do, and this is kind of fun if you've never done this, if you've ever went to school and watched kids with their lunch, it's a fascinating behavior. And Kraft had Lunchables, and we knew a lot about kids' lunch behavior. But it's always shocking because, you know, the boys will occasionally eat their sandwiches, but pretty much throw away any vegetables or fruit and go right to the chips and candy. Girls tend to throw away the sandwich and maybe will eat the fruit, but typically if you looked at the wastebasket, there's like a ton of fruit at the end. And the people who show up with candy and cookies are quite popular in the trading world because, you know, you can always trade for if you want Doritos or some savory snack. In any case, so we had done that, and we went out and started talking to moms. And we were talking to moms who were quite restrictive about kids' diets. These are moms who say, I'm not going to let my kids have chocolate. You know, I make sure they only eat the most nutritional things. So we had built up some pretty good information from them about what they rejected. So we decided we'll go visit them in their homes. And we opened their fridge, and the fridge in the kitchen was completely full of fresh vegetables and juice and looked like it was pretty healthy. And one of the questions I would always ask folks, and occasionally we would even look in their medicine cabinets because we kind of wanted to know about their health too on different projects, but we would say, is there anywhere else you store food? So you'd go through the cabinets and then you'd push them a little harder. Is there anywhere else you store food? And in the Midwest, it's a fairly common phenomenon for what we call the beer fridge. And it's not always used to hold beer, but it's an extra refrigerator, sometimes a freezer, out in the garage or in the basement. And I remember we were at someone's house, and we'd seen this, you know, they're very restrictive mother and, you know, told us how there was no junk food in the house. We said, well, can we look in the refrigerator in your garage? She said, okay. And we open it up, and there's all this Mountain Dew in there. And I will tell you, I'm like the biggest Mountain Dew fan in the world, and I switched to Diet Mountain Dew a number of years ago. But the fridge is completely full of Mountain Dew. So what's the Mountain Dew for? It's for special occasions. So we push a little bit harder on the special occasions. Well, it turns out, like, well, what kind of special occasions? Well, the kids can have it, you know, like when they get home from school. And people typically laugh at that because they think, well, how's that? It's like every day. That's not really a special occasion. But what we realized is that in many moms' minds, kids go off to school. They really don't have the opportunity to freely choose snacks throughout the day. They're kind of trapped in the classroom. So when they get home, it's a little bit like getting out of jail, you know, and kids kind of feel that way too, right? It's like, oh, I'm home from school.
Yep.
And they're allowed to then have this treat. So we asked them some other questions around how do you decide what is an appropriate serving size? And a lot of this has been corrected, but if you go back 15 years ago, a lot of the serving sizes were sort of bizarre. You know, it might have been like 2 3/4 of a cookie or something like that. And how most people decided was often based, particularly if they were packing lunches or packing snacks, on the size of snack bags that they had. So you had people had these little thin ones that would maybe hold 3 cookies, others that had sandwich bags that might hold 6, and other people that had quart size where we saw moms dump half a box of Oreos into them. So the long story short is we realized portion control was actually a big deal. We came out with 100 calorie packs. Of course, when I worked at Frito and Quaker, we had to do 90 calorie, but that's another long story. The other interesting thing is mostly these products, particularly the 100 calorie packs like Oreos, were largely rejected by kids and pretty much eaten by dieting adults, partly because you've had them. They're not exactly Oreos. They're good, but they're not exactly Oreos.
So just as an aside here, because I happen to be a fan of Mountain Dew, I've been really good about decreasing my intake, but in high school, 6 cans a day was pretty normal. Was that one part that was appealing with joining PepsiCo?
The Mountain Dew?
Yeah.
Well, I suppose. I was oftentimes asked a lot of questions when they were doing work on Mountain Dew, everything from ads to packaging to line extensions because of my crazy devotion to the brand.
You had good insights.
part of the opportunity was, if I had to be, the brutal honesty is we had gotten a little bit slow at launching innovation at Kraft, and there was an opportunity to go into PepsiCo and really make a difference right away and launch a lot of new products, which I was able to do.
Yeah, and the Mountain Dew line is actually pretty interesting from a product development innovation standpoint. I don't know if this is still going on because I drink less Mountain Dew these days. But for a while, they were very much in the campaign of doing co-development with customers, where customers would suggest new flavor ideas. And it seemed like once a month or maybe more, there was a new version of Mountain Dew coming out in response to that whole program.
Yes, I will not go down the food line extension path further than to say a lot of product development in food are close in line extensions.
Yes.
I'll leave it at that. Yeah, I think the reality, though, most of us realize, particularly after years of doing new product development and innovation, you have to do a little bit of everything. You have to innovate processes. You have to innovate services. You have to innovate products. And when you innovate products, you do some very close-in things, from change the color to change the flavor to things that are really invent new categories. And all of those do kind of fit in innovation. To me, broadly defined, innovation is creativity brought to the market. It's actually commercializing a creative idea and putting it out on the market.
Good definition. And I usually tack on the end when I talk about those things is in a way that creates value that is distinct from what competitors are doing right now.
It's great.
The aspects there that you went through of the stories really do a great job of emphasizing that power of observation and where we really need to start when we go down any path of improving a product or developing a new product is making sure we're truly understanding a problem the customer has. And all the better if it's a unmet problem that hasn't really been observed. You know, as you talked about that story of the beer fridge, the extra fridge in the garage or basement, and how that is being used and how people think about the appropriate serving size and what those observations led to in terms of capturing some more market by providing a valuable product. There is another aspect of all this I'm curious to get your take on with your position as an innovation officer. And that's, it gets talked about a lot, but it's actually really challenging to do, this issue of putting in a culture of innovation, getting people to think about innovation, you know, in a productive way. Can you share about that a little bit?
Sure. And I tell people, you know, I was brought in to build a culture of fearless innovation and also a culture of connecting with customers. And it is a never-ending journey when as much progress as you've made, there's always a little bit further you can go. But without shifting the culture, if you don't change the culture, the processes really won't matter because people will just, I don't want to say mindlessly go through them. They'll check the box that they're doing the process, but they won't really integrate it into the way they think about coming up with new products to the way that they actually do product development.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been a big piece of what we've done. And we've done a couple things with that. I mean, one thing that I do, and it probably shocks people, but I probably spend 4 days out of the week out talking to customers, both my internal customers within the organization, but really getting them out with their end users, leading that effort, helping them go out, talk to users, watch users, synthesize the results, helping them fill their pipeline, because I think we really have to lead by example. And the more that senior folks do that, the more it's going to trickle kind of down. So that's one thing that we do. We spend a good percent of our time as a corporate innovation group helping all of the product groups get out and interact with their end users. And again, it ranges across a bunch of different industries, across a bunch of different geographies. And largely, this is we're usually serving a blue-collar customer. And so some folks aren't as comfortable with that. But, once you get out and do it, you realize it's really, some of the best kind of work you can do.
Absolutely.
The other thing that we've done is, we also do a couple of other things. We built an innovation center in 2009. When I was originally asked to do this, we thought about going offsite. And I went and toured a bunch of different innovation centers. The great thing was, I came from the CPG world, so I knew all these people in CPG. They really didn't care if I, went to Kraft or Pepsi or Coke or ConAgra or Wrigley's. Didn't matter. They were fine to let me into their innovation centers. And a lot of people in the industrial space, like, Boeing and IBM and companies like Tesla, were more than happy to let me come tour and learn about how they were doing innovation. But the key thing I learned out of that was, don't go build something off-site if you have the capacity to build on-site. You want to be near your users, your internal users. So we ended up, the facility we're in had a manufacturing facility up until about 2005. Most of that production was moved up to Milwaukee, a little bit of it went down to Alabama. But by and large, it was sitting empty, being used as a warehouse. So we repurposed the space, and I don't even know how many tens of thousands of square feet we have now. But we built an innovation center. We continue to add on. We add rooms every year. We've sort of built the rooms and structured it so it replicates the process, if that makes sense. From, hey, here's some areas where you do training. Here's areas where you debrief and come up with ideas. Here's areas where we do sketching and rendering. Here's areas where we do rapid prototyping. We have a full functioning garage. Here we have a van channel where we keep a fully stocked franchisee van. So we have everything from, again, ideas to go to market. We have areas where we can observe customers work. And, you know, we continue to add space. The other thing that we do, in addition to the training piece that I talked about, where we go out and work with our internal customers to make sure they're working with their customers, their end users, is we give out innovation awards as well. So once a year, we recognize anywhere from 20 to 30 teams and a few hundred associates with innovation awards. And we try to recognize, and this is important because it's not just for products that launched. It's for everything from having a good insight to having a good idea to building a great prototype to coming up with a new way of doing things to a new service to a new product. You know, the majority, over half, are probably new products, but we make sure that people are recognized for taking some risk and for coming up with the idea, just not for physically delivering the product at the end. And in addition to our leadership conference, where folks are recognized and giving physical awards, we actually remodel every year part of our space here to put up a huge display that recognizes those award winners. And another thing we've done is we also have we call a patent wall, where we put up all of our patent awards from the beginning of the company in 1920 up till now. And we put up little representations of each of the patents. We just had to turn the corner on the wall this year because we had so many of them.
A new meaning of turning the wall on the corner. More space like that. So you brought up so many things there that could be a whole other discussion on its own. Let me follow up with just a couple questions. Spending a lot of time, 4 days a week, getting product teams out with end users. This is a great way of making changes in the innovation culture, because then the product teams get to see what the users are actually caring about. But when we say product teams, who are you actually taking with you? Who are the people that you're getting in front of users?
Yeah, so this range is typically, I mean, the most common folks are people in product development who are doing product development, as well as the product managers. So folks in functions like marketing and product management and product development, whether it's software development or, you know, engineers doing, you know, electronical engineering development, you know, through mechanical engineers. Those are the typically kind of folks. But we also have people from sales, and we have people from customer service, and people from finance who will go along just because they have a little different perspective. Mm-hmm. And across a broad range of customers. Again, majority of our customers tend to be what we call technicians, people who fix things that move in the transportation industry. But we're also talking to managers and owners of businesses, because we produce business software for them, as well as large OEs and manufacturers like Toyota or Boeing. In addition, once we get overseas in Europe, we do a big business with the trade. So last year we did a big project on pruning, and I was talking to people in California and Oregon and Washington that prune vineyards and pick grapes. So we talk to a broad range of customers, and we bring along a broad range of folks. The other thing, just to add on to that, in addition to when we go out, we do a little bit of training before they go on how to best listen and observe and ask great questions, which I tell folks, these are good skills to have if you're interviewing people or being interviewed, in addition to talking to customers about them. So it's just kind of good basic skills to have. We then go and do the work. Then we make sure we facilitate a debrief and that we help them turn those observations into insights, those insights into opportunities, and those opportunities are then, you know, turned into sort of a pipeline and some specific actions on how those will end up going to market.
Excellent. Thanks for adding the detail there and bringing, you know, not just the product managers and the product developers, but at times people from marketing, sales, finance, the other functions. That's really how you influence the culture of innovation, by exposing all the functions in the organization to this customer-centric way of thinking. I was also curious about the awards you talked about, the innovation awards. Do you involve customers in that process? Do customers see how some of their contributions made it into something new that someone at the company received an award for?
We don't involve them in that process. Well, let me step back. We haven't until this year. And this year I'm actually going to recognize some customers with innovation awards. But I can't talk too much about that yet because I wouldn't want them to find out we're doing it. It's going to be kind of fun. We have an open innovation program that we run. We give out right now, and the dollar amount will probably be going up fairly soon. If we commercialize an idea, we will give the person who came up with the idea $3,000 cash. They don't have to do any IP or anything. We also send them, because a lot of them are users that come up with ideas, they get the first dozen products. And we receive, it depends on the year, but several hundred, anywhere from 200 to 500 ideas a year. And we typically commercialize around 90 of those. It's a pretty high hit rate.
Yeah.
A lot of them are very highly specialized tools. And like I said, for the inventors, these are oftentimes folks who have no interest in commercializing the product. They typically just send in a sketch. Sometimes they'll have a prototype carved out of wood. You never know what you're going to get. And we do that for them, and they are, recognized as inventors. They get the cash gift, and they also receive the product that they can give to their sort of friends and families and coworkers as bragging rights. We have another program that we do, too, for outside inventors, where we will work out a deal if they come up with a great idea, where there's some royalty sharing, or sometimes even where we allow them to manufacture to our specifications, and we will help them sell the product. That's a little less common. But if people have IP, we will extend sort of a royalty deal to them. And most of that we're reasonably public about and spell it out quite clearly for people who want to provide us with a new idea.
Excellent. Yeah, a lot of opportunities for open innovation and a lot of practices going on. We could keep talking about this. This has been so very valuable. Shared a lot of insights from your position as a chief innovation officer about how to think more customer-centered and how to influence the culture, and love the examples along the way. As listeners know, I also love getting innovation quotes. And I asked for you to put one together for us. And the one you're sharing that you sent me ahead of time is, "No one ever makes a decision because of a number. They need a story." Tell us why you picked this one. What does it mean to you?
I think it was from Amos Tversky, and it was, if you're not familiar with him and another guy, Daniel Kahneman, did a lot of the work that eventually led to behavioral economics. And so these are guys who are really into numbers. And I like that because I always tell folks, and I probably for 20 years now have given this speech to people that work for me, if you go into a room and you're trying to sell your idea to senior management, have a great story. No one ever believes the numbers unless they want to believe the numbers. They want a cohesive team that can tell a story. And when I talk about telling a story, I think one of the great things about innovation is you can go out, you can have an observation. So you can say, oh, here was what I saw, here was the aha or insight that I had, and here's the idea that I came up with. When those things string together with perhaps a little bit of background about, oh, yeah, we can sell this many of them, and at the beginning it's this big of a market, you can sell almost any idea. So having that great story is a phenomenal way to really drive innovation. And we actually do a fair amount of when we do our customer connection training, one of the things we talk about is, how do you get good at telling great stories? And I have a little bit of quick training on that. I'll just talk about some of the key bullets for people to take away. First of all, you actually have to get out and do stuff. If you never get out and do anything, you don't have any good stories. Very few good stories come from sitting at your desk. Second of all, you have to actually pay attention. If you don't pay attention, you can be involved in something really interesting, but if you're the person looking at your phone, you didn't even know it happened. So you got to pay attention. Third, you have to be able to sort of tell the story and then skip the extraneous details. Get to the point. As I say, don't fill a blue book. Because if you get way off base, then people get lost in the story. So having that aha, having the insight, staying to the point on the story helps. And then the fourth thing I usually tell people is you got to have some empathy. If you don't have empathy for the characters in the story, you really don't care about them. Example is any great movie you've seen, even if the characters were despicable, if you liked the movie, you had empathy for someone in that movie, someone in that story, someone in that book. So, and we spend a lot of time training people. I didn't talk about this too much, but on increasing their empathy skills, because if they're out listening and observing their users, they have to have empathy for them, have to really walk a mile in their shoes and understand what's going on in their lives.
Absolutely. Essential for doing observations. Those are great tips for telling a story. You know, get out and actually have the experience, pay attention to what's going on, tell the key parts of the story, that aha moment, and then make sure you are exhibiting empathy as you are involved in all this. Ben, such great information. Thanks for taking time for this and sharing your experience there at Snap-on and the previous places you've been with innovation and how products come to life. And I want to thank you again for making this work out. I appreciate everything you shared.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. Find a summary of the discussion with Ben and other useful resources at theeverydayinnovator.com/120. This is also a great place to share this podcast with others. Just click on one of the social media buttons at the top of the page. Again, that's at theeverydayinnovator.com/120. Keep innovating.
Thank you for listening to The Everyday Innovator, which teaches product managers to become product masters. For more resources, please visit our blog at theeverydayinnovator.com.